Welcome to today's Ballwork Podcast. This is our special weekend mega cast. Probably should have a PSA right at the top of this. You might want to have a drink before listening to this because we are going to take a deep dive into the insanity that appears to be infesting the mind of the President of the United States. But before we do that, we have some news. This podcast has now been downloaded more than 6 million times since we launched it in January, and we are going to be expanding our stable of podcasts. We are going to be growing our podcast footprint. And by the way, our guest today, Tim Miller, has got this fantastic piece on conspiracy theories. But by the way, hi, Tim.
Hi, Charlie.
And our publisher, Sarah Longwell. So, Sarah, tell us a little bit about the new podcast.
So we're really excited about the new podcast. It is called Beg to Differ. And, you know, the Bulwark has been this unique place in this time of tribalism and partisanship where even though we all come from kind of the center right, we try to approach a lot of these issues with maybe a fresh look, and we try to be open-minded, and we invite people in from all walks of life. And so you're going to have Mona Sharon and Linda Chavez, who are going to represent sort of our right of center on Beg to Differ. And then we're going to have Bill Galston and Damon Linker, who are going to represent our left of center. And it's going to be a weekly podcast, a deep dive. They're going to be talking about not just news of the week, but bigger themes. And, you know, I also want to just congratulate you, Charlie, because 6 million downloads in I think what is maybe 9 months, 10 months
yes,
is just a massive achievement. And as a result, we're going to expand our podcast empire with this new podcast. And so I hope you guys will check it out and download it. It will be in your Bulwark feed. And if you are not getting us in your feed, go get us now.
And, you know, the thing about it is that we have had such fantastic guests. And I was thinking the other day that if I made a list of all the people that I really, really wanted to have on the podcast and talk to, we've already talked to those folks. And in fact, we're doubling back and getting them on, you know, second, third, fourth time. Okay. So let's just jump right into, this weekend. The text messages that were released on Thursday night, they're being described as the smoking texts. I actually think they're like the fiery texts because they're hotter than just smoking. And then, of course, everybody else is using the term smoking, so we have to come up with something different. But let's start with you, Sarah. I mean, do you think these are the smoking guns of all of this? And, of course, I'm assuming that people know what we're talking about, the diplomats who seem to be laying out how gobsmacked they are that the president is engaging in quid pro quos, that he's holding up a meeting with the Ukrainian president in return for, you know, political dirt. So your take on what we've learned in the last 24 hours.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really going to come down to whether or not Republicans continue to engage in this sort of like we tell them the sky is blue and they say it sure isn't. That is a purple sky if I've ever seen one, because it's the idea. When you hear these guys, when you look at the text messages, they're talking, they're also having an offline conversation on the phone. And one of the guys is trying to explicitly say that he thinks it's crazy based on the discussions. And so he's trying to put it out there. I don't have the text in front of me. And if you do, Charlie, you can help me out.
I do. I'm looking at it, actually. Okay. This was Bill Taylor, who was the diplomat that replaced the Ukrainian ambassador who was removed from her duties, it seems like because she was not willing to play along with crazy Rudy Ball, which is going to be relevant later. So, yeah, it was Bill Taylor, and his text said, quote, crazy to withhold security assistance for help with the political campaign.
And then that's pretty straightforward. But then the other guy basically says, no, that's not what we're doing. And so in the way that the conversations have evolved thus far around the Zelensky phone call and everything else, Republicans sort of immediately glom onto that second part, right, where that person was very aware that they couldn't let that stand and immediately wants to move it to a phone call.
Yeah, he waits five hours to do that, and of course he's the Trump donor. He's not a professional diplomat. I mean,
first a Jeb donor. I'm ashamed to say. I've had a few exchanges with Ambassador Sondland.
Oh, you have? Interesting.
Oh yeah.
Is he like an enforcer? Because that's how he strikes during these exchanges. It looks like he is like very much Trump's enforcer in these moments.
No, I wouldn't say enforcer. He is. My impression, I guess, let me just caveat this. I've met him one or two times and we've had a couple of phone calls. So, you know, I don't have a deep knowledge of his personal character traits, but he, my impression of him was more of as a pleaser, you know, and with big donors on campaigns, you get, you know, the types that just want to complain. You know, you get the types that don't, that just want to give their money and don't really say anything. The types that just want to go to the big events with the big names to get their pictures taken for their wall of their office. And then you have kind of another category that's like, I want to be involved. I want to make the campaign happy. I want to get quoted in the newspaper. I want, like, how can I, you know, and this was Gordon. And Gordon was very much, you know, wanting to be, you know, quoted for us and wanting to see what he could do for Jeb. You know, and now obviously we know he's angling for ambassador jobs, so that makes sense in retrospect. And so to me, that's how this reads, right? Who knows what happened during those 5 hours, but, you know, when he comes back and is the, you know, kind of the water carrier here, it's like, okay, I'm going to be the guy that comes in and, you know, so that when these texts eventually leak, you know, everybody knows that I was on the team here.
Yeah, at some point they realize, guys, we're texting this stuff. Right. Maybe we shouldn't be texting. I think Philip Bump has a pretty good breakdown of the three what he calls deeply problematic aspects of these newly released text messages. I mean, number one, there is an explicitly stated quid pro quo. We're sort of past that now. The number two, the U.S. helped shape a statement from Ukraine that would have explicitly mentioned the Biden probe. They actually wrote something up for them. And number three, there's a strong suggestion that military aid was used as leverage and hints at an attempt to hide that. So we are really past the point of, you know, debating, was the whistleblower right? Did the president actually throw his weight around? Trump seems to be standing out there saying, you know, damn right I did. Yeah, damn right. I have the absolute right to ask anybody to investigate anything. And not only did I ask the Ukrainians to do it, I asked the Chinese. And you have Republicans who are prepared to step up and go, yeah, that's right. What's wrong with that? What's wrong with asking for investigations?
Charlie, I wanted to ask you about that because one of those guys is Ron Johnson.
Yeah, I know.
From out there in Wisconsin. What do you make of his posture on this? You must know him personally.
I do, quite well. And unfortunately, you know, this is to say it's a massive disappointment is putting it mildly. You know, I think here's a guy who has taken his lead on politics for many years from the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal. Now, up to a certain point, that was probably a pretty good thing. You know, it meant that he was a solid conservative. He was savvy. He was a free market guy. But I think he's followed them down the rabbit hole that they've gone on the Russia issue, on the Mueller probe, and on a lot of this stuff. That is not a good look to defend the president asking the Chinese to investigate. I mean, there's some, like, you know, asking the Chinese. David French has a great tweet. He says, our president is allegedly so concerned with transparent financial dealings and rooting out corruption that he urges even a communist regime to investigate his political foes, yet he won't release his own tax returns. And most of the congressional GOP seems just fine with that. Wow. Ron Johnson is apparently all in on this, which, considering that my understanding was originally that he wasn't going to be running for re-election again, seems puzzling. But, you know, this is where we're at in the Republican Party. I mean, as of right now, you have Mitt Romney, who put out a pretty strong statement, but Romney's pretty much alone, isn't he?
Can we just go down the Chinese rabbit hole here, though,
sure,
for a second,
please.
Since you brought it up?
Yeah.
I thought so there was the separate leak. It's hard to keep track of all the leaks, man, and all the information that's coming out now. It's really a fire hose. And so I do worry some of this stuff gets lost. So the report that was, you know, again, take it maybe with a grain of salt because it was a background report on Trump's call with Xi. I thought one of the interesting elements of that for me, or interesting in the, you know, depressing sense, is that Trump did mention the Bidens in that call. But that he also, essentially said that he would, hold back in comments about the Hong Kong protests while they resolve the trade dispute. You know, and so, you know, to your point about Ron Johnson and you know, these guys who were, you know, up until recently, you know, Wall Street Journal editorial board conservatives, like, here they are running defense for somebody who is asking a communist regime to put together a fake investigation on his political opponent, who is asking the communist regime to work with him on an absurd protectionist trade war that is, you know, at best haphazard, and tells the communist regime that he will not speak out on behalf of the American, you know, country, the American population, our, you know, our history, you know, in defense of those who are protesting for their freedoms and rights. I mean, this is on each point literally the opposite of what, you know, Ronald Reagan, of what the Wall Street Ed Board would do, of what traditional conservatism is. And none of the, like, the cognitive dissonance seems to be missing here. You know, I mean, none of them are even, you know, besides Romney, like you said, showing even like a little bit of internal tension over defending this.
The on one level, you know what his strategy is, that he's just going to, you know, stand on the, you know, South Lawn and say out loud the quiet part, right? There is no cover up anymore. I mean, it's all in plain sight. And it seems to be, he seems to have this idea that if I say things publicly, that somehow it's not a crime. Of course, you know, you can obstruct justice, you can do a variety of things, you can abuse power in public. But I mean, it will be interesting when we ever see the transcript of that call with President Xi, which I think, you know, may be a bridge too far for some folks. But I mean, let's just stick with China for a second here. Okay, Sarah, the Chinese, you know, obviously there's this major high stakes trade war, and the president has just given them a massive bargaining chip in public. So the Chinese say publicly, well, we're not going to interfere in American domestic politics. But these are savvy guys, and they realize this president may be about to sell out his country. He may be willing to sell out manufacturers and farmers and you know, other national security interests. If we just throw him a bone, if we just give him some, you know, some dirt on Joe Biden, we're going to get something for it. I heard Susan Rice on television last night, and she was saying that, you know, that she would be gobsmacked if the Chinese didn't take advantage of that. You know, when basically the president says, hey, I'm willing to give you something at the expense of my country's interest, if you give me some shit on Biden, you know, why wouldn't the Chinese go along with that?
Yeah, so two thoughts. The first is, I've said this before and I will say it again, this guy is the worst negotiator on the planet.
He's like, terrible.
The idea that we were supposed to buy into this absurd farce of Donald Trump being president of the United States because he was going to be like the best businessman ever and like an excellent negotiator. Like, this kind of stuff, when you see the behind the scenes wrangling that he does, the extent to which he gives it all away immediately, exposes himself to, I mean, forget everything else is negotiating position, like blackmail from these countries. Like, it is, he could not be dumber about this stuff. So that's number one. Number two, like, how scared is he of Joe Biden? Like, imagine giving away all your bargaining chips and your entire negotiating position in order to, like, just get information on Joe Biden's son. Like, to me, it exposes, and I've wondered about this for a long time, because I think there was a strain of thought out there a while back, and I'm going back maybe a couple of years, where the idea was Donald Trump doesn't really like being president. He's not going to run for a second term. I mean, you heard this all the time from Republicans who were like, just don't get so worked up. He's not going to do it. He hates this. But of course, as his legal exposure has grown,
loves it.
Yeah, so first of all, he loves it,
by the way. Just as a quick aside, I'll let you do the legal exposure, but he loves it. He would be president until he died. Mm-hmm. Are you kidding me?
Which is made clear, right? Like, and just the idea of being at the center of this. But I also think, like, there is tremendous legal exposure. Like, I think he has gone from not at all wanting to be president in 2016 and using it essentially as a business opportunity to now desperately with everything that he wants to hold on to this power.
And that's exactly right. And I just want to drill down on one other point that Charlie said. And we talked about this a little bit the last time I was on, you know, when I was going back over, you know, my work in the past, having done Oppo, bringing up, you know, kind of these conflicts of interest among the Clintons. And this was at the core of why why we have transparency rules and of why we try to ensure that there are no conflicts of interest. Because, you know, in those Clinton cases, it was always like this bank shot, like, oh, well, they've got a donor giving money to their charity, you know, that's from a certain country, and now they're meeting with that country. Is that going to impact, you know, what their you know, conversations, right? This is, as you said, just the most overt version of that on steroids. And he's saying in front of the national TV audience, you have this chip on me. You know, this is going to impact our negotiations. I'm willing to you know, make concessions in this idiotic trade war, you know, if you help me politically. I mean, it could not be more overt. And, you know, as we were saying here, I just got a text message that, you know, our friend Marco Rubio just said, I don't think that it's a real request. You know, so like we're this is Tim,
you can't take him literally, Tim. You just got to take him seriously.
The president, it's not a real request. Okay, so what does, I mean, how can you defend this idea? I mean, he deputized a shadow secretary of state to fly around the globe to act on this request, right? I mean, he's been as explicit about it as you can possibly be. And so, you know, for the, you know, Rubios of the world who internally still have this, ooh, communist China, you know, I can't go full bore for this. You know, their only play is to fall back on this, like the president is an idiot. It's the president is an idiot defense. You know, yeah, and that's like from people who want him to be reelected. That's the case that they have left.
Two quick points that are extremely obvious, but just need to be, you know, mentioned. Number one, you know, Trump's playbook of projection. You know, this is one of the most corrupt presidents we have ever had. You know, his family is, you know, he and his family are just, you know, blatantly engaging in self-dealing. And think of all the stories that we've had over the last couple of months about all of that. I was watching a tape of him yesterday, and he says the phrase, it's all about corruption. It's about the corruption, you know, about four times in 40 seconds. So here you have somebody who is very vulnerable on the corruption issue, and he's throwing up all of this dust. I think it would be naive to think that it might not be effective. Number two, David Corn over at Mother Jones. Yeah, we are going to quote Mother Jones here. Had a great point, saying, you know, it was just a week ago we learned about one of the most abject moments of betrayal by the president. You know, that story from 2017 when he was in the Oval Office, yucking it up with the Russian ambassador. And the latest report is that he allegedly, and we'll find out maybe at some point, you know, told them, hey, don't worry about the election interference. Everybody does this. Which has tremendous implications because this was an attack on our democracy. They will continue to attack our democracy. And we have an election looking ahead. And here's a president who doesn't take it seriously at all. So let's just put this aside. I'm struck by the Republican response, at least in the last 24 hours, that a lot of people have been unusually quiet about all of this. But to the extent that we're hearing from Republicans, it seems to be on process rather than substance. That a lot of the focus is about the process, is about the process of the whistleblower, going after the whistleblower, who now seems to be less and less significant since his story has been corroborated in so many ways.
I mean, more than corroborated.
Just
a brief aside.
Yes.
It's so strange that they went after the whistleblower when they knew that what was going to come out was actually worse than what the whistleblower said. That was a strategic move I don't quite understand anymore.
That is remarkable, but it is going to be interesting to see how much is on procedure. Sure. Okay, so now we have to do this, and I have to say that I have mixed feelings, even though I loved your story. Okay, so Tim, for people who are listening to us now on the Bulwark website, Tim has a story: being Donald Trump inside the world where conspiracies are reality. And it does something that's important because we've been focusing a lot, of course, on the president's abuse of power and quid pro quo. But at the root of all of this is this batshit crazy conspiracy theory inside the president's head. And I have to say that I've always sort of in the back of my mind going, and it's just this nutty conspiracy theory. But what you have done is and this was dangerous. You know, this was like, you know, you
for
took
my
the
mental
red,
health.
Yeah. So you went in like, okay, let's pretend we think like this. What do they think like? And I just want to warn people. I mean, this stuff makes your head hurt. I mean, you spend time on this. So let's walk us through what is going on in Donald Trump's head.
It really does make your head hurt. And I started writing this. I forget what prompted it. It was one of those Rudy interviews over the weekend last weekend where he was saying, you know, and Obama was in on it and Clinton and Chalupa. And I was like, you know, I should actually kind of write something that says that, that the premise is, what if Rudy is right? You know, and so I started going down that rabbit hole and looked into all, you know, what, watched all the Rudy interviews. And about Monday, I got about halfway through writing it. I'm like, it was so painful. My head hurt so bad trying to follow the connections that I had to take a break for 36 hours, which is why it didn't come out till today. But, you know, the premise, why I think it's a really valuable article before I get into it is that, you know, look, these are very complicated issues, right? And what happened in 2016 is very complicated and very opaque. And what happens with intelligence is very opaque. And people have a tendency to buy into conspiratorial thinking when they don't, when they can't, don't have a handle on things. And I've even found myself sometimes, you know, hearing an argument that they make and being like, well, that one, that part of it could be right. Mm-hmm. You know, that part of it could be right. And so, you know, so you have, until you put it all together in one place, it, you know, we all knew it was batshit, but I, even I didn't really understand how freaking batshit insane it is until I put it all together in like one timeline. It's like, okay, let's start at the start. So, you know, that's what I did basically. And I think for people who are not following this, you know, essentially, you know, there's the Biden element of the story, but there is also the relitigating 2016. And right now, you know, Attorney General Barr is traveling to Italy to track this down. Rudy was, that was his original purpose for going to Ukraine. The Trumps believe that the story that's being told publicly about 2016, that the Russians interfered and that the Trumps, you know, kind of knew about it at some level and welcomed it and lied about it, even if they weren't necessarily, you know, in on the, you know, in on it from the start, is not true. And that it wasn't the Russians and that it was actually the Democrats who colluded with the Ukrainians and maybe some Russians. It's hard to say. Okay.
Let me, and then possibly there was an
inside job.
Okay, so let me just read this paragraph. You know, basically say, forget about everything you've known about the Russian interference. Instead, consider the possibility that the U.S. intelligence community, desperate to prevent Trump from ascending to the presidency, worked with the Clinton campaign, Democratic National Committee insiders, intelligence agents in multiple foreign countries, and Ukrainian oligarchs in order to fabricate evidence of Russian interference and cover up what was an inside job all along, and that they used former spy and dossier author Christopher Steele as their vehicle. That is what the president and his team seem to believe.
And you that are... is why Hillary Clinton is the president today.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. So here's the thing. I know. And I think it's important to just continue to drive this because it's a fun narrative to read, I think, if your head can stop hurting because it's just so absurd. It's kind of like reading a crazy fiction spy novel. But so it's important to run down this. Like, they believe, like, at some level, they believe this, right? They believe at least some part of it is true, you know, or else, you know, the president wouldn't be talking about it in a private phone call with the Ukrainian president, right? You know, I mean, for I think that there's this idea that maybe they just put this stuff out through AmericanGreatness.com and Breitbart and whatever as a way, as kind of a shiny object to get people to focus on. But this is why Attorney General Barr is in Italy right now. And so, you know, I went through it. The two main, you know, the crux of where this begins is with the Steele dossier, which you mentioned, which they claim, you know, the intelligence agents, you know, through, you know, some a relationship between one person at Fusion GPS and the intelligence agency hired Christopher Steele to. It's not clear whether he fabricated this all or whether they planted it with him with other intel agents. Okay, so that's one. And then two, they hire this mysterious professor, Joseph Misfood, who's in Italy, and have him offer Russian emails to George Papadopoulos. And then have a separate Australian ambassador meet with Papadopoulos under the, you know, basically the premise that they knew that Papadopoulos would spill the beans and give them a reason to start this investigation. This is what they believe. And here's the key point of this, Charlie, before I go down just really quick, is all of that stuff happened before WikiLeaks started leaking emails.
Right.
So WikiLeaks didn't start leaking emails till July. Steele was hired in March or April, and the Papadopoulos conversations happened in April and May. So in their theory, they already knew that somebody was doing something when they set up those patsies for this investigation. And I think that that is, you know, among some of the, you know, crazy and fun and depressing side notes of this, kind of a core element of just how absurd this whole thing is.
Okay, but the real absurdity, I mean, yes, the fact that there was this massive intelligence conspiracy to frame Donald Trump early on in 2016, that's crazy. But what's really crazy about this is that internally it makes no sense. I mean, it makes no sense because they, you know, having done all of this, having, you know, have this, you know, intercontinental conspiracy, they didn't let anyone know. They didn't use it before the election, right? We heard that the FBI was investigating Hillary Clinton, but we were told by the New York Times and by others that there was no links between the Russians and the Trump campaign. So, you know, how do they internally in their minds, with this massive conspiracy to frame and smear Donald Trump, that none of the framing and smearing took place before the actual election to the presidency?
The best answer I've ever heard the crazy town folks give on this is that they didn't actually think Trump was going to win, so they didn't do anything about it.
This was the insurance policy, right?
Oh, so yeah. Again, though, that's one of those things that you're like, okay, that actually sounds like that could be possible, right? If that's the only piece of the pie that you know, that like these guys had something on Trump, but they assumed he was going to get crushed like everybody else did, and so they're like, let's not expose ourselves. Okay, so that would make sense if and only if you don't know the entire backstory of all the things that they did. And so I write this at the end of the article under the title Checkmate. You know, they seeded the phony dossier. They entrapped Papadopoulos. They tapped Carter Page's wires. Unclear again why they tapped Carter Page's phone, not Paul Manafort's, if they were just going to break the law and go for, you know, actually tapping somebody's phone who mattered. But put that aside. They engaged intel officials in three countries in a spying operation. Lindsey Graham just this week, by the way, on Hannity said that that's possible, that happened. They allowed these emails damaging Hillary Clinton to continue to drip out through WikiLeaks. They just went behind the scenes to the media and to Harry Reid to kind of imply this might be Russia. They created a false flag CrowdStrike cover-up, which we haven't even got into. They received a Ukrainian Manafort file. They got Hunter Biden some walking around money. They got Obama in on this. You know, so Obama is in, the vice president, the head of the CIA, the head of the FBI. Everybody is in on this conspiracy to stop Donald Trump. And then at the end of the day, they're just like, you know what? Actually, we're not going to do anything about this. What we're going to do is we're going to open up reopen an investigation into Hillary Clinton, who we've been doing all this to support. And boom, now we gotcha. You know, and then, as you said, Charlie, leak it to the New York Times. So again, like this idea that, okay, you don't act because it was more of an insurance policy only makes sense if you hadn't walked through all the other things that they did, at which point, you know, you're left to wonder, okay, well, you know, none of that seems to follow.
So it was a double false flag?
A double false flag.
I don't even know what that
right?
is.
So the first, okay, so a false flag is when you have a fake action in order to get a reaction, right? So the first fake action and the first false flag, you have to stick with me on this one.
Yeah, okay.
The first false flag is the DNC. Okay, so the DNC leaks. To believe this conspiracy, you need to understand that the Russians didn't actually break into the DNC. Somebody involved in the intelligence community did, either in Ukraine or in an inside job. And so the first false flag is letting these emails go out anyway, right? Because you'd think if the intelligence community was supporting Hillary and they actually were in on this and it wasn't the Russians, they just wouldn't have published the embarrassing emails. Like, that would be Occam's razor. But no. They did a false flag, which was to let the emails get out into the public. And then as the election approaches, the double false flag, so that nobody would get on the scent of what they did, is to reinvestigate Hillary and tell the New York Times that all the things they fabricated about Donald Trump did not happen. It's the double false flag to keep everybody off the scent. But luckily, the people at American Greatness and Rudy Giuliani have uncovered it, have gotten through both false flags to figure this out.
Oh, my God.
This is one last element on this, Charlie, because it's important for you know, everybody's having fun now. Shoot me. But this does tie back into the core Ukraine complaint of the impeachment. And that is that this conspiracy that they've been trying to uncover in 2016 is tied directly to the Joe Biden, Hunter Biden conspiracy, which I lay out in here, that they needed a patsy. They needed a patsy country to work with to pin this thing on the Ruskies, right? You know, if somebody was going to be leaking these false flag emails, it had to be somebody. And so who is going to do it? The Ukrainians. Why? Because they were already in on this whole thing with Hunter Biden. So they already kind of had them in the trust tree. So they worked with the Ukrainians, the Obama Intel folks did, in order to, you know, pin this on Russia. And so, that's basically what happened here. I'm sweating now. I'm like, am I the crazy one? I haven't even gotten into Seth Rich, but yeah, this is what the president might not actually believe all of this, because I bet he's never put this all, like, spent the time to actually think about it. You know, he's just like throwing shit at the wall.
Yeah.
Like, and somebody like gives him one Gateway Pundit article and he's like, that makes sense.
Yeah.
He's not trying to keep it consistent. Rudy actually is. Rudy kind of betrayed the game a little bit in one of his emails over the weekend when he was being pushed by, I think, Wallace on the CrowdStrike thing, or one of the guys. And he's kind of like, well, I don't know if I believe that part. Because, you know, Rudy at least, you know, might be in a little bit of a scotchy haze, but that he at least kind of is following the story that he thinks is true. Whereas Trump, I don't think is. And so, you know, whereas he might believe each of these things individually, I don't know that he's ever, like, you know, tried to tie the plot together in his head.
Oh, my. See, now, help me with this. Sarah, you watched Homeland, right?
Yes.
So what was the main character's name again?
Carrie.
Yeah, Carrie. You know, when she has the wall and all the strings and everything that connected and everything. No, I think that Donald Trump probably hasn't connected all those strings. He is just throwing stuff up against it. And a lot of these people have done this, because when you actually say, if this happened, you know, you have to believe this as well. It becomes so crazy. So I find it deeply alarming that the president of the United States takes this seriously.
I was just going to say, I mean, is that the most alarming part? Because to me, the most alarming part is, look, democracy is only as strong, our democracy is only as strong as the party in power's willingness to police itself, right?
That was exactly where I was going, that is alarming on this. But this is one of those areas where it's so crazy that this seems like an easy place for Republicans to draw a line, say, hey, you know, we're going to be with you on the judges, we're with you on the tax cuts, but we are not going to be with you on this crazy stuff, particularly because it involves, number one, you know, discrediting our own intelligence agencies. And number two, it provides cover for, number two, it provides cover for the enemies, the Russians. And number three, it makes it much more difficult for us to defend the country from future attacks. This seems like an easy one for the Mitch McConnells of the world, right? That we're not going to even like listen to this crap anymore.
And yet.
The opposite, actually. I mean, one of the things that started getting me down this rabbit hole was, it was about a week when the first transcript went out about that call. The CrowdStrike thing jumped out at me, and I saw a tweet from an advisor to McConnell who was trying to, you know, kind of finger wag at the media and be like, you guys are all obsessed with this Biden thing, which was like a minor aside. What you should really focus on is the president's serious topic of discussion he brought up, which was CrowdStrike. And it was that tweet that made me think. I was like, is CrowdStrike a serious thing? Because I thought it was a cuckoo thing, but I've never actually taken the time to really read up on it. And so that is kind of what started me down this, this tunnel, this very dark tunnel that is the Trumpian conspiracy theory. And so, yeah, I mean, the McConnell guys, they're doing the opposite. Cornyn was, I don't have it in front of me, basically tweeted this conspiracy theory today. The only reason I saw it is because people were tweeting my article at him. And he basically was saying that, like, Obama, you know, fabricated an investigation into Trump, you know, based on a dodgy dossier.
Wow.
You know, and now Barr is trying to get to the bottom of that. And so I can't believe that it's the Democrats who are hypocrites for not letting Trump investigate Biden. You know, because they've spent the last 2 years it's the upside down.
All right.
You know? So, and these are normal, like, not normal. Normal is maybe the wrong word, but what was before Trump kind of the center of the party.
So, Sarah, is there the possibility? I don't want to make this worse, but I will here. is it possible this is going to work in the sense that it just throws up so much dust, so much fog, that people just shrug their shoulders and say, we have no idea what happened?
I would say no if I was in my brain 3 years ago, but I just sat through the whole Mueller investigation and watched them do exactly that, and watched Barr sort of shamelessly frame the narrative and cloud it up enough with all the Page and Strzok and all that stuff that people couldn't get their heads around it. And so I have seen it work. Hey, let me just raise one thing that I can't figure out. I'd love to get your guys' opinion on. So Donald Trump this week, I know we're the news cycle goes so fast that we're trying to limit ourselves here to the last 48 hours. But earlier this week, he was tweeting out a bunch of insane things about civil wars and the fact that this was a coup, right? And one of the things that seems crazy to me that all of these Republicans are willing to gamble their credibility on this guy and wear him like an albatross around their neck for the rest of their careers is it's not like if Donald Trump gets impeached or removed through the 25th Amendment or he resigns that like the Democrats get to take over. They don't. Mike Pence gets to take over. And so I just can't figure out why they are willing to go down with this ship in such an extreme way.
Well, I think just that, you know, part of it is simply the habit. And then, of course, there is just simply there's also the fear that they're looking around, like who's going to say it first? Who's going to step out there? Because you know what's going to happen. There's a fascinating piece in The Washington Post about the smearing of Mitt Romney. And, you know, that's
fascinating.
That's in store for anyone that steps out. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, you want to go next. You know, the first guy that walks, you know, steps up, boom, he gets shot. OK, who's next? There is that, but it is an extraordinary scene, but it feels like a continuation and an escalation of something that we've seen over the last 5 years, Sarah.
Yeah, well,
my answer is double. Just if you don't mind, to answer your question, I would just say I think there are two things that are happening. One is groupthink, which is what I tried to puncture with articles like the one I wrote this morning, which is I think that they're, you know, so it's sociable. You know, you're in at this point, everybody's in the bunker together. And Cornyn, I think, even believes this BS that he's tweeting, right? Like, really? They're just not thinking about it critically. I think that at some level they know Trump's a little cuckoo, but like, I think that generally they feel like the media is out to get him and that it's unfair and that the Democrats, you know, are even more insane and that this is all justifiable. And so I think that groupthink has really set in, number one. Two, I think that there's a political, it's just short-term political calculus, right? These guys don't want to be the sacrificial lamb. Every senator wants to be president, you know, so even as ridiculous as this sounds, you know, some of these guys are like, I'm at running 2024. You know, I can't be the first one out on this. That ruins this. If I can't, I'll never run in 2024, 2028. You know, all of these folks are still thinking about that. So I think that those are the main reasons that they don't jump out on them and move to Pence. You would think that maybe a McConnell or somebody, you know, who's more senior and more calculating might try to game that out. But there hasn't been a lot of evidence of it.
No, I think that's true. You know, and flipping, you know, back to what we've seen in the last 48 hours, setting aside the conspiracy theories, the president standing openly asking the Chinese to collude with him in taking out Joe Biden. I did it with the Ukraine. You know, what he's essentially doing, he really is daring us to accept his behavior. And Ben Wittes over at Lawfare just had a great piece about this, you know, saying that his defense could be even worse than the crime in some ways, because when vice pays no homage to virtue but is open and proud, it presents a special challenge to accepted morality. And here's the example he gives. If somebody steals cash, hides it, and denies the theft, the act poses an enforcement problem. But if one steals cash and then, once caught red-handed, publicly defends the act as legitimate, that defense poses a challenge to the norm itself. And that is what Trump is doing, because the boundaries of acceptable presidential behavior are defined by what we tolerate or what we condemn. And so if he succeeds in normalizing, you know, his behavior and gets, you know, 40% of Americans to think, absolutely, get foreign countries, you know, to give you dirt, trade off national interests in exchange for political advantage. That's going to come this is Ben Wittes's line, at a great cost to previously unquestioned first principles of constitutional governance. And quite frankly, that worst case scenario looks likely given the way you have politicians like my good friend Ron Johnson saying, I got no problem with that.
The big political differential here is whether or not there's going to be a handful of Republicans who start to try to change the dynamic and say something. And I was pleased today to see Mitt Romney. This is only like an hour and a half ago. Yeah. He tweeted, when the only American citizen President Trump singles out for China's investigation in his is his political opponent in the midst of the Democratic nomination process, it strains credulity to suggest that it is anything other than politically motivated. By all appearances, the president's brazen and unprecedented appeal to China and to Ukraine to investigate Joe Biden is wrong and appalling. And I think it is good. That's a strong statement from Mitt Romney. And the question is will Ben Sasse and will Susan Collins and will Lisa Murkowski and will Hurd and, you know, some of these other Republicans that we all know personally or at least know them, have followed their careers long enough to know that there are decent people inside of each one of them who are appalled by what's going on. The question is whether or not they will be an early enough mover on condemning this, that there's an opportunity to really change the momentum. Because I fear the longer it goes on with Trump just kind of putting it all out there and Republicans saying nothing, the more everybody just kind of plays that duck and cover game.
Can I be the downer side to Sarah's optimistic potential?
Always you are.
Yeah, exactly. So back to Wittes's point, here's the thing that worries me, is I think that I what Romney said was great. So, I like to support people who are doing the right thing. The issue is when push comes to shove. And I think that there are a lot of, you know, people who are our friends, who are conservatives, who don't like Trump, but maybe, you know, are willing to, you know, the balls and strikes crowd, let's call them. They're looking at this and saying, okay, bad, but not removal. And so this is my problem with, you know, this is where you get back to the Wittes argument. That's something that is very concerning about this, which is, I know this is, you know, I think it was Kilgore Trout who coined this as like moron contra. Yeah, this is dumb, right? I mean, this is on some level, you know, can feel like it's a silly crime, a silly reason to remove him. But here's the problem. It's prospective about 2020. So if everybody decides this happened, Trump did this, it's bad, but it's not impeachable, that's basically like saying, you know, we're just going to wag our finger at him and come to it and set the precedent that a president can work with foreign countries on upcoming elections and ask them to interfere using the power and influence of the federal government. And that is very serious. And like the potential other ways it could be used, both in this election, but in future elections with more competent and evil presidents, is why this thing comes back to, if you believe what Mitt Romney thinks, I just don't know how you can come to any answer besides removal. Because of that precedent setting. And I just think that this sort of calculus that Wittes laid out about how he's forcing people's hand to make that choice. And I'm not very optimistic that people are going to make the right choice.
I'm not either. But the point, though, also is that this is prospective, looking ahead at the interference in the 2020 election. I mean, this is what makes it different than the Mueller investigation. That was looking backwards. This was looking forwards. It really does involve whether or not you're going to be serious about defending the country and national security. The thing about this is that this feels very unsilly. I mean, this is not a blowjob in the Oval Office. This is not.
That's true.
This is not even a third-rate burglary at Watergate. This feels like it involves, you know, real issues of national security, of corruption, but also of constitutional governance. But
Trump just seems silly, I guess is what I meant. You're right. That's a good correction, though. But yeah,
well,
you're right.
Well, even Nancy Pelosi has said he's not worth it, you know, but now she's developing this line that he's not worth the effort, but the Constitution is worth the effort. Okay, let's talk about Joe Biden. Joe Biden's had a pretty crappy week. Okay. There is indication that he's slipping in the polls. His fundraising number was not fantastic. He's comes in third. Elizabeth Warren just dropped her number. She's pretty well close to Bernie Sanders. He's in third place. So are we watching, despite everything we've said here, a successful murder-suicide? That yes, while Trump may have self-impeached himself, he is in the process of destroying Joe Biden. Who wants to take
I'd like to hear what Sarah thinks. My one sentence on this is I'm sad to say yes. And I sometimes I feel like I'm fighting for Joe Biden harder than Joe Biden's fighting for Joe Biden on this. And I mean, that's kind of where I land right now.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think I said this on the MegaCast last week, how like insane it is that Joe Biden can't seem to turn this moment into a positive for him. I mean, the extent to which the president is willing to go to extremes to not have to face Joe Biden could have massive upside for him were he willing to actually grab this issue and run with it. And Charlie, you did what I thought was a tremendous soliloquy last week of what Joe Biden could say and sort of seize the upper hand. And I don't know whether it is him or his staff, but I think it is a huge red flag that they are keeping him in some, you know, candidate cryogenic chamber and not letting him out. I mean, he's not on TV.
Yeah.
He's not going out there and defending himself. Mm-hmm. And they either think he is incapable of it or, well, that's actually, that's all, or he like, or they've made some kind of calculation that like he actually loses more if he does that. But I think that is the wrong calculation. He is playing a two-front war right now. And the only thing that, the thing that works in Joe Biden's favor is being the inevitable candidate, is being the front runner. And if he loses that, he's not going to be able to reclaim it.
Okay.
Yeah. So my only quick thing. There is a debate, what, 2 weeks, 10 days. So I guess he'll have an opportunity to have a moment on this then. But boy, if he doesn't, it's, I have to agree with Charlie and Sarah's assessment on that.
Well, I have a question because I'm not in the political strategizing business. So is it plausible? Somebody said, well, okay, maybe their calculation is, and it's probably what Sarah just said, but maybe their calculation is, look, while Trump is in the process of imploding, don't step on that story. Don't make it about you.
Yeah, if this, was a head to head with Trump, I'd buy that, but it's not. Mm-hmm. Elizabeth Warren is closing in. Elizabeth Warren is closing in on him like nobody's business. And go ahead. Sorry.
I was just going to say. And here's the thing that he had over Warren before, and maybe this was unfair to Warren, but Democratic voters who I talk to, there is a palpable concern about redoing Hillary. Right. Mm-hmm. Like there's PTSD. And so with Warren, maybe it's sexism, you know, you know, she doesn't deserve that. But that is was a real thing that voters were feeling. This could be, and that was something that Biden had on her, this kind of sense that he'd be more electable.
Yeah.
That is totally changing on him right now, where he is seeming more like Hillary. It's like, oh my gosh, this is the exact same thing that happened to Hillary with the emails is happening to Biden right now. And that was like his main advantage over Warren.
Yeah. And I mean, she is pure as the driven snow, right? I mean, save Jacob Wall's weird sex scandal thing that he's accusing her of or whatever that is. You know, Elizabeth Warren, you can't hang her on any of this corruption stuff.
She really is a
Washington outsider. I'm sorry.
Pocahontas. You get him.
No. I'm not saying she's not vulnerable. I'm just saying if one of Hillary's big things was that they were able to muddy the waters enough to make a moral equivalency between Donald Trump's corruption and Hillary Clinton's corruption, the extent to which they could redo that playbook with Joe Biden and Donald Trump, despite the fact that on every scale that you could possibly weigh these against, they aren't even in the same universe. I could see their hesitation on litigating it. I mean, honestly, I still think Joe Biden's the best candidate to do it. I have been really let down over the last week or two in how they've handled it, because it seems to me like they've taken what has the potential and is being a negative that absolutely could have been a positive if they'd turned it around.
I agree with you completely. Okay, so let me raise one very uncomfortable topic that I probably will regret raising. You know where I'm going on this. It's remarkable to me, you know, the restraint with which people are analyzing Bernie Sanders being in the hospital, you know, having a, you know, heart issue. And I'm not a doctor, but he clearly had, you know, issues and had to have a stent inserted. If this was Joe Biden, it would be over, right?
Totally.
Biden had an incident, it would take every issue about his health, about his age, and it would be done. It's just a matter of time. And yet people are not really applying that standard to Bernie Sanders. Is that because Bernie has faded so far that nobody's taking him seriously anymore anyway, even though he's the number one fundraiser? I mean, why would this be fatal for Biden, but Bernie just, you know, is going to keep rolling on, or is it really just this, or is the clock ticking on Bernie too?
Clock ticking on. I think one is just the expectations game, like you're saying, Bernie. People, you know, have. I think actually at this point he's undervalued, but people sort of decided that Warren has passed him and his time is up. And number two. You put me in this uncomfortable place, Charlie, so I'm trying to think about the most diplomatic way to say it.
Yeah, right.
You know, Bernie, despite being crazy, you know, old Bernie with his shtick, you know, doesn't really, you know, his performance in this cycle and in these debates has been pretty much the same as it was 4 years ago, right? So, you know, I think that whether it's fair or not, there are people who have been pointing to Biden gaffes, you know, and saying that he's losing a step. And like that, there hasn't been that, you know, kind of around Bernie. And so I think that is the other reason, in addition to the handicapping, why this has not been such a big deal. And I think thirdly, the lucky break of going to the hospital, you know, the same time the president was, you know, caught committing crimes red-handed.
That could be any day.
I would not underestimate the role of all of the rumors and the spin about Hillary's health back in 2016. I mean, that was just a staple in conservative media and conservative talk radio. I mean, she was on death's door. I mean, her fainting around Labor Day turned out to be a really big deal. So I just throw this out. Okay, anything else on your guys' mind over the weekend? I mean, this is just insane. Go ahead.
I think that idea about their ages, though, I understand why you think could be indelicate, but like we should, when people are trying to political pundits, when they are gaming out how this could all go and they're thinking about who's up and who's down and different people, the fact is all four front runners, Biden, Sanders and Warren, and then Donald Trump are all in their 70s, some of them closer to their mid 70s. Mm-hmm. They are running presidential races, which physically, mentally, emotionally is more grueling. It would be hard on a 40-year-old. Like I bet Pete Buttigieg is worn out. And so I think that it would not shock me in the least bit if Bernie Sanders is the first but not the last of these candidates to experience a medical issue, and that it could become a bigger problem. And Trump could be in there too. It's not exactly like that guy's taking great care of himself.
Nothing else for me, Charlie. I'm just going to spend the weekend cleansing myself from the muck and the mire of the, you know, MAGA Sean Hannity world that I drenched myself in this week.
It was a great piece, Timmy.
Thank you. I strongly urge people to print it out and read it. You may need two different reads, and I would recommend you know, perhaps having a scotch beforehand, before the new tariffs kick in. You know, as well. And by the Well, listen, you guys have a great weekend. I'm sitting here just feeling incredibly old because Diane Carroll has died. And I remember as a kid, I really had a crush on her. I really did.
Charlie, I don't know who that is.
I don't know who Diane Carroll is either. I'm trying to Google it really quick.
Just forget it.
Porgy and Bess. Stop. I never heard of that.
Oh, she was outstanding. But to really read that she was 84 years old, it was just, oh, man, it's just so I'm just going to crawl back in my old guy cave here. So, all right. Thanks for coming on. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Charlie.
Great first mega cast. I love the mega.
They are very, very popular. Hey, and thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. We'll be back on Monday, and we'll do this all over again.